Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 13th, 2011. Seems like a good time to buy a house, right? Low interest rates, low prices, but the home buying process could also bring you low.
A lot of tears, a lot of craziness. Oh, no, it was so horrifying. It got to the point where I was like, I didn't want the house. You know, I was at a breaking point.
We'll look at the challenges facing new home buyers. We'll also explore why consumers may not be willing to get out of their cars and onto public transport despite rising gas prices.
Many people remember the first car they got and how that produced a certain kind of independence. So that makes this an especially emotional type of product.
And it's National Etiquette Week. Have you minded your P's and Q's?
I will never send you another check because you never thanked me.
Amen. Dear Prudence steps into the bully pulpit to preach a money faux pas. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. We start with this week's good news, bad news number. Home values fell in the first quarter by 3%, the worst decline since late 2008, and terrible for homeowners. But on the other side of the calculation, home value is also home price. And if you're in the market to buy, it just gets better and better. Not to mention mortgage rates are rock bottom. But as many a house hunter will tell you, right now there is no guarantee of success for anyone hoping to own. Marketplace's Eve Tro has our story.
When Christine Fazzino moved to L.A. about a decade ago, she and her husband stuck to a tight budget.
We lived here for 10 years in a one-bedroom. That's how we saved all of our money.
But you knew you were saving that money to buy a house.
Oh, yeah.
Now they have. Fazzino met me at her three-bedroom home in Los Angeles. She was lounging in the sun by one of its major selling points.
The pool, of course. Yeah, it's kind of nice.
They got the home for $160,000 less than the starting price. So happy ending, right? Well, Fazzino says it's hard to see it that way. She's still reeling from half a year of hard negotiating to get the house.
A lot of tears, a lot of craziness. Oh, no, it was so horrifying. It got to the point where I was like, I didn't want the house. You know, I was at a breaking point. It was just like, I'm done.
She and her husband had already bid on several homes and lost out to real estate investors who offered cash. When they did get a bid accepted, the sellers almost backed out because the loan approval was taking too long. The bank wanted better proof of income for Fazzino's husband. He works on a TV show that was between seasons.
We were going to lose the house, this house, and they were going to take our deposit because on our end, we weren't getting the loan.
They had to scramble for a new broker and bank to get the loan. When they finally moved in, what should have felt like victory felt muted. Fazzino says buying a home used to bring hugs and cheers from friends. Now?
They don't know what to say, you know, because you don't know. Did they overbid for that house or can they afford that house? Or, you know, what is the American dream? Honestly, for me, I have anxiety.
Because since the crash, her dream of home ownership comes with a new set of concerns. What if the home loses value? What if she loses her job? Add those anxieties to the higher standards to get a mortgage, more money down, impeccable credit, and a lot of would-be buyers are saying no thanks. So says personal finance author and columnist Kimberly Palmer.
Buying a house and moving into your first home really used to represent stability. And now we would so much rather have money in the bank that we can access immediately if we want it.
She says younger professionals are still inclined to buy for lifestyle reasons, like when they have kids. But the recession changed the idea that renting instead of buying is a waste of money.
You can't ignore the fact that buying real estate is a huge risk.
One that might bring as much personal pain as it does pleasure. Grace Wong Bucchianeri studies housing at the Wharton School of Business. Her research shows we may have been deluding ourselves about the benefits of home ownership. When she surveyed hundreds of women who owned or rented single-family homes, she got striking results.
Homeowners are actually not happier, and instead, consistently, they show a higher level of pain associated with their home.
That shows up in ways like poorer health. Her data show owners weigh 12 pounds more than renters on average. Owners travel less and spend less quality time with friends. And she did this research in the good old days of 2005, when homeowners were probably at their happiest. Now, this is just one counterintuitive study, but Bucchianeri's research also challenges a long-cherished belief that homeowners care more than renters about their communities.
I don't find a very strong relationship overall between the home ownership rate and the civic participation or the general attitudes towards the neighborhood.
Renters were just as involved as owners, and that might mean that the financial risk of owning a home is not justified by the presumed social payoff.
Having good living conditions and being in a place that you're happy with doesn't have to involve putting all your money in one basket and own a home.
If happiness and home ownership don't go hand in hand, that's one less selling point for shoppers in this spring home buying season. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace Money.
I'm a renter. Over the past couple of years, renting has been a good money-saving move for me.
Commentator Chris Farrell.
The numbers were in my favor during the boom and the bust. So why is now the time to make your move if you want to own? We all know that there are millions of foreclosed properties weighing on the market. All the experts say things are only headed further south. So why buy when we're still not at the bottom? It's all about cashing in on extremes. During booms, enthusiastic investors encourage each other to drive prices into fantasy land. And during busts, the gloomy conversations get increasingly intense, pushing prices down, down, and down. The real estate fundamentals say the crowd is too downbeat. Rents are rising, interest rates are low, home prices are down. Homes haven't been this affordable in 30 years. This doesn't mean you'll get rich fast owning. At best, you'll earn a modest rate of return on your investment. It has averaged nearly 6% a year from 1978 to 2008. Housing typically does about as well as short-term T-bills and worse than stocks over the long haul. But you get to live in the investment. Here's the thing. You'll have improved the odds of doing okay financially on a home because you're buying after the market has cratered. That was the experience of bold buyers after the bust in the 80s and the 90s. There's another trend working in favor of owning. A home is a hedge against inflation. And that protection against inflation is one reason homeowners have been traditionally willing to accept a relatively modest rate of return. Yeah, inflation is low right now. But considering the recent rise in fuel and food prices, it isn't hard to imagine that inflation will stir as the recovery ages. What am I going to do? Am I ready to leave renting and a landlord for owning and weekend maintenance? I am tempted, really tempted. Still, 3 more years of college tuition lay ahead, so I'm hanging on for now. You, on the other hand.
Chris is the economics editor for Marketplace.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplacemoney.
The oil industry took a beating on Capitol Hill this week. Executives from all the major gas companies argued that subsidies to their companies are not the cause of high gas prices. The national average for a gallon of gas is just shy of $4. Several states passed that mark weeks ago. It hasn't been this bad in 3 years, but at what point might the price get high enough to change our behaviors? Lars Perner teaches marketing at the University of Southern California and has studied that question. We asked him to meet us in the Inglewood Oil Field, a series of derricks near Culver City. Lars Perner, thanks for joining us out here in the middle of the Los Angeles oil fields.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we are experiencing right now very high gas prices in this country, although I think there is some debate over whether they're going to keep going up or if we've reached a tipping point. What is the tipping point for the American consumer? Is it possible to say that?
Well, I think there are several different tipping points. The round numbers such as $2, $3, $4, and $5 tend to be psychological barriers, what's difficult to go over. I think if we reach a $5 per gallon price point, that's a round number. It's about half a ten, so that's going to probably be especially significant.
Is there anything special about the price of gasoline that differentiates it from other things that we purchase and make decisions on, whether it's finally too expensive for us to put our money toward?
Well, possibly with the exception of food and housing and other things, it's one of the more expensive components of our budget, so that's one factor. But the other thing is the more psychological association. A lot of people associate cars with freedom and the opportunity to travel. Many people remember the first car they got and how that produced a certain kind of independence, so that makes this an especially emotional type of product where you may have feelings that go beyond the actual dollar amount.
And that actually affects what we're willing to pay for gas?
It affects it to some extent, but I think more importantly, it's something that creates more anxiety and much more of a feeling of violation now that you lose your freedom to travel as much as you've been used to. Not that you necessarily would exercise it that much, but you feel constrained.
It seems like within the past 2 weeks, 1 week we heard that, well, actually, the tipping point isn't going to be until probably $5. Well, then by the next week, the tipping point seemed to be $4, and demand was starting to slacken off, prices dropped. Do things really happen that quickly?
Well, I think what we're facing here is that there's a short-term reaction. So when you hit the $4 mark and you haven't been used to that for a while, then you're going to be in denial and shock for a little bit, and you're going to have some immediate effects. But there's a limit to how long it can last. Eventually, the desire to drive and to fill up, it's going to win out. A lot of people might also have waited a bit longer to fill up, rather than filling up at half a tank. They might have tried to wait desperately to see if it came down, and they may have filled up when you were close to the half tank. So if you have a lot of people doing that, that will affect dramatically the daily demand, and that could have some impact on the short-term prices. But again, people have to get used to the new round number every time it occurs.
So if and when we do reach $5 a gallon, that at some point will become our new normal, and then $6 will be the tipping point.
Yes, ultimately $6 could become a tipping point, but remember, once you reach $6, we've gone through so many different dollar breaks that it's going to be somewhat less. It was especially bad to when we went from less than a dollar to a dollar, then we went from between $1 and $2, and we hit the $2 point. That's a huge psychological barrier. It gets gradually less, and by the time we reach six, we've gone through so many different breaking points that each one might be less significant.
Lars Perner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, what do you do at the end of your meal?
They should tip what they feel their service was. So, customary tip nowadays in restaurants, I would say, is between 15 and 18%.
Tips on tipping, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. It is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff from Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Hello, Kathy.
Hey, Tess.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Everybody is talking about precious metals these days because there's been this huge run-up in commodity prices. There was a whacked-out run-up in silver a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
What is going on here, and is it going to stop?
The funny thing is I'd written a story about silver for Kiplinger's because in December we had recommended that people have some silver because it was going up and we thought it had farther to run. And then 2 weeks ago, I did the story saying, take your profits right now. Congratulations, you did really well. Now get out, right? And before it hit print, the market just dropped through the floor. And so now, of course, we're updating and I'm going to talk to people about whether it makes any sense to have these commodities in your portfolio.
I'm actually very surprised that you would have recommended anything as specific as silver. If you're going to go and buy silver or gold or platinum or oil, any of these commodities, you better know what you're doing.
Absolutely. And you really should only have this as a really tiny piece of an overall portfolio, right?
Because it's super volatile.
It is super volatile. If you have commodities in your portfolio, it actually helps you diversify because commodities are poorly correlated to equities. And so the idea is you want something going up when something else is going down. Having up to 10% of your overall portfolio in commodities, a broad basket of commodities, that's smart. That's a smart way to diversify. Having 10% of your assets in gold or silver is insane because it actually adds volatility to your portfolio. It doesn't subtract it.
All right. Well, let's go to our golden callers, shall we?
Let's do that.
Michael is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well. And you?
Good. I'm great. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, you bet. What do you do there in Chapel Hill?
I'm a librarian, actually, for a large university library.
Do you specialize in any topic?
I'm the librarian for math and physics.
Okay, well, we are automatically out of my bailiwick.
Yeah, mine too.
Do you know a lot about physics, or are you...
I know just enough. The nice thing about being a librarian is that I can kind of dabble in it and know the kind of superficial information in the area, but I don't have to be an expert.
And you know exactly where to look it up.
That's right. I know how to find out more.
Perfect.
Well, so what can we help you out with today? Because we certainly cannot, I think, either of us help you out with any physics.
Definitely. Sure. Well, my wife and I are in the process of buying our first home.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And we have found one, and we were working with a broker to get some more or less traditional financing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all ready to do that. And then at the point that we found our house and started to negotiate the contract, my parents surprisingly offered to finance us with a private loan.
Oh, my.
Wow.
So that was great. And, you know, we were going to set it up more or less like a regular loan, and we were going to make payments and have interest on a schedule.
For what, like a 30-year fixed?
30-year fixed. That's right.
Okay.
Great.
And so we've done some research, and it sounds like there are pretty good financial benefits to doing this, such as fewer closing costs, and they were going to give us a lower interest rate. But I just wondered if there are any downsides that we haven't considered or any non-financial considerations that we should be thinking about.
Well, boy, this is really interesting. You know, Kathy, I think we're hearing more stories like this these days because the banks are not nearly as willing to give out money. And so, you know, I think friends and family are taking a look at this as an option. But
yeah.
But you do have to set boundaries, and it sounds like they're on their way to doing that.
Yeah, private loans are becoming huge. But let me ask you something. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister.
Have you guys looked at this as part of an overall estate plan issue? And have your parents talked to your sister about this stuff? Because if you're looking for potential problems, the potential problem is the Thanksgiving table, right?
Right.
And that's, you know, does your sister feel like she's being disadvantaged by what your parents are doing for you?
Hmm.
And so what you, I think, want to do is make sure that you contemplate whether this is a fair deal, make sure that it is properly documented and that you are, you know, paying interest and all that stuff. And then I would just talk to my sister. I mean, do you have a good relationship with your sister?
Yes, very good.
Then you just want to talk it through so that nobody's shocked at what you're doing and you understand what the estate planning repercussions might be.
Yeah, and actually, I had an extensive conversation with my parents, but I haven't done the same with my sister, so that's a good idea. Are there any financial things that we should think about? Tax implications or credit or
anything like that? Yeah, Kathy, how does that work? I mean, this is not something that's going to go on the credit report, so that's out. But in terms of, you know, just the general paperwork, I mean, you have a deed and a title and, and you know, the setup of the loan. And, you know, Michael did say that, you know, they're talking about perhaps a lower interest rate, but you do have to watch what that interest rate is, because the IRS is going to check that out, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the IRS would look at it, and if it was way below market, they would impute a value, again, for estate planning purposes. Do you want to go through one of these lending facilitators, like person-to-person lending facilitators? They actually just document the loan for you and process it so that you get the same sort of treatment from that loan as you would from a loan from a bank. And if you think that not having a mortgage loan will adversely affect your credit score, that might be worth the expense of doing it. The tax implications, too. You want to get a year-end tax statement so you can deduct the mortgage interest.
Right. You just want to make sure you're dotting all your I's and crossing your T's.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it sounds like a great deal. It's wonderful when your parents have that sort of economic wherewithal to pay you. And also, you know, they know you. They know you're a good credit risk. And so you're probably going to be paying them more than they could get it from a CD in the bank.
That's
and
for
so
sure.
It can benefit both parties. It's just a matter of making sure that you document it, right? So
sure.
So let us know what you end up doing.
Okay.
Give us a call back and tell us if you end up going with the bank or the bank of mom and dad.
Okay, will do.
All right. Thanks for the call, Michael. All right, and Ellen is now up with us. She is in Minneapolis. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
What do you do there in the Twin Cities?
I am a Spanish teacher.
Spanish teacher. So you're a native Spanish speaker?
Not a native Spanish speaker.
No.
I'm a Minnesota native.
So do you have a Minnesota Spanish accent?
Yes, exactly. I try hard to mask it. I work hard at it. But I did also live in, after I graduated from college, I did also live in Mexico for a couple of years. And that's kind of where the teaching thing sort of started.
So who are you teaching Spanish to now?
Well, that's my issue here. I teach elementary Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And as you are well aware, a lot of districts are having to make some really difficult cuts.
Uh-oh.
Right. And that would be with the elementary Spanish program in my district.
Oh,
after
no.
about 14 years.
Wow. So you're losing your job?
Yes. So that's why I came to you, looking for some suggestions here.
All right. Well, how have you planned so far?
Well, I am certainly looking for work and am applying, but I have to admit I'm trying to focus on the window opening end of this experience, and so sort of I'm taking stock of my financial picture and have been for a long time considering working abroad again.
Wow.
And so, but I kind of want to make sure that I'm in a position to do that.
Speaking of windows, why don't you give us a window into your budget? What kind of asset versus debt situation are you in?
Okay, well, I'm 48. I have, right now, just cash on hand. I just have about $7,000. I have a mortgage of about $100,000. It's a 15-year mortgage, but the house is probably worth about $260,000, and I'm actually considering selling. So that's sort of part of my picture.
Okay. Great.
I have a traditional IRA account with about $220,000. In it,
great.
And a 403B with about $50,000 in it. But then I have a credit card balance with about $4,000 on it, and I was about to slam dunk it, and I thought, let's just think about that. So, but I also have a HELOC for $52,000. So, a few pieces there.
Okay, so
I think that's everything.
You know, Kathy, I my first inclination is to set aside all the retirement money and not even kind of count that in this because you don't want to touch it.
Right, exactly. You know, the first thing I guess you look at is paying off that credit card because you do have the $7,000 in cash.
Mm-hmm.
It does make sense to pay it off. The only caveat on that is you do need something to live on, right?
Right.
And if you've only got $7,000 in your emergency fund, you might need to preserve that just to hold you over. How much do you absolutely need to live on if you bare-bones everything?
I think somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $2,200 a month.
Okay.
I live pretty carefully. My daughter's off to school.
Great.
And her dad kind of, you know, I help out, but he covers a lot of that.
But essentially what we're saying is that when you lose your job, when you lose that income, you have probably 3 months before you're in real trouble.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, sounds about right.
Okay, so you need to figure out how to extend that 3 months. And there are a couple of things you can do.
Okay.
First of all, the immediate thing I would do is start looking for self-employment opportunities. Advertise your services as a Spanish tutor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Advertise your services as a translator. Advertise what you can do right now to get additional income while you've still got a paycheck.
Now, Kathy, she also mentioned that she's, you know, thinking that it might be time to sell the house.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ellen, have you been following at all how long houses are staying on the market in your area?
Not closely.
Yeah.
I do live in it's a modest neighborhood, but it's a fairly high demand area. But I haven't been watching the number of days that the average house is on the market. So
yeah, because that'll give you some idea of maybe how long it might take you to sell the house.
Yeah,
okay.
And you know what? Before you do that too, you should check out what it would cost to rent in your area.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure you'd actually be saving money by renting versus, you know, holding your own home right now.
I see what you're saying.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. And finally, we have Jennifer from Tucson. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hope that you're going to be able to keep your job.
I am. Actually, I left my job in February, and I have launched into a freelance graphic design business, which is fortunately going very well so far.
Congratulations. Well, good for you. So this is exactly, Kathy, what we were telling Ellen could potentially happen for her.
Yeah, it sounds similar.
Jennifer, how did you make that decision to make that leap into self-employment?
Well, I was unhappy at my job for a long time, and I think sometimes life sends you messages, and I just ignored them for a long time. And then I finally, finally dawned on me that I could do this on my own.
Well, it sounds like you got everything taken care of. Why do you need us?
Well, I'm actually calling because I don't know how much I should save for taxes. I've had a lot of freelancers tell me, make sure you save money for taxes, and not really knowing what I'm going to end up with at the end of the year, I'm not really sure how to plan for that.
Yeah, good question, Kathy. You know, this is when you don't have a predictable income, it's very difficult to figure out what you're going to owe Uncle Sam.
Right. Yeah, it sure is. And this is exactly why Uncle Sam wants you to make payments quarterly. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't started making quarterly tax payments, you probably need to do that.
Okay.
The deal is, particularly when you're self-employed, trying to anticipate what your tax is going to be is insanely difficult. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because you have far more deductible expenses than you ever had when you were working for an employer, and far more opportunities than you ever had before. But you also have to pay both sides of your Social Security tax. Mm-hmm. And so that's a bigger expense. And so it's a juggling act.
And you speak from experience.
I do, because I too am self-employed. And my biggest advice would be find a tax accountant who understands self-employment income. Find somebody who works with other self-employed people, because they are worth their weight in gold.
Okay.
In terms of saving for taxes, what I actually would recommend is, instead of thinking about saving for taxes, I would think about spending.
Spending?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is really more in the mindset of, every 3 months, I'm going to spend this amount on taxes. So I'm going to figure that if I have a good quarter, I'm going to put in extra amount for taxes. You know, this, always do whatever the percentage is that you think you're going to owe, whether you're 15 or 20 or 10% tax bracket. Just set it aside like you would figure that you're doing an automatic savings program, and then boom, slam it against, you know, send it into the IRS so that you don't have to worry about accumulating a tax debt that you're going to have to pay at the end of the year.
Okay.
So the real issue is that it's tough to know your cash flow, especially when you're starting a business. And so when you have the cash flow, use it to spend on things that you know you're going to need to spend on earlier in the year. And if indeed you do overpay your taxes in this instance, and you find that, you know, the final quarter of the year is tight, then you get that tax refund, and it actually helps you float your cash flow a little bit better.
Okay.
Jennifer, is that something that you'll be able to handle financially?
Yeah, I think so. Thus far, I've been just putting 50% in the bank, knowing that that should more than cover it, but I really didn't have a guideline.
50%? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you. I hope that's not your tax bracket.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you're going to...
That's so I can be safe.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Thanks for the call.
Sure.
All right, our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, thanks for coming in. It was fun as always.
Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, including In the Plex by Stephen Levy or The New Frugality by Chris Farrell, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplacemoney.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
I'm Sarah Harris. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. And we are at the Greater Birmingham Humane Society in Birmingham, Alabama. This is my wallet. I've had it for about 3 years now. And it kind of collects stuff. I've got these guitar picks. I've had them for about 3 years ago. I think it was my junior summer in college. I followed this band around. I got these picks from hanging out after concerts. Also from the concert when they threw them into the crowd. This one's from a concert in L.A. This one's from a concert in Marietta, Georgia. I always forget that I have them in here for some reason, and I've been meaning to do something with them forever, but I just kind of carry them around. I was thinking about making a picture frame out of them and just kind of like a memorabilia type thing after a while, but just haven't got around to it.
All right, stop us if this sounds familiar.
Customer service, this is Kelly. Oh my God, I am so sorry. That is so messed up. Everyone here is so upset, you have no idea. And rest assured, your voice has been heard. Customer service, this is Kelly.
Customer service, the bane of our consumer existence. Now, the old-fashioned phone call might work if you can get through the phone tree. But these days, one of the best ways to get a company's attention is to tweet them. Now, we asked our Facebook fans and Twitter followers if any of them had been successful Twitter bullies. Kathleen Riley tweeted us back with this story.
Last year, I ended up in a situation where my car broke down on the side of the road. I called a service that I have that's supposed to supply me with a tow, and they refused to authorize the tow. I ended up having to pay for it myself. The next day, I got onto Twitter and started to tweet about it and ended up being contacted by a customer service rep via Twitter, and that person ended up offering me a partial refund. It didn't cover the whole tow, but it was better than nothing.
All right, good for her. We are going to expand on this in next week's show, so we want to hear more of your stories. Tell us your story on our Facebook page or tweet me at Radio Tess. It's easy enough to say please and thank you, but the rules around money etiquette, not easy.
You have to say, you know what, this year we're trying to dig ourselves out of the hole. Please, let's not exchange gifts.
Dear Prudence marks National Etiquette Week with some advice on manners of finance. It's next on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. How much do you tip? 15%? 20? 25? Well, what started out as a way to reward good service is now pretty much a given. You tip even if the waitstaff pours an entire bottle of wine on your head. So if you're going to tip no matter what, at least you've got all kinds of gadgets to help you do the math these days. But in some ways, technology has made tipping even more confusing than ever. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Let me sketch out a couple recent experiences where the credit card receipt presented me with tipping conundrums. One happened at lunch in a deli here in Los Angeles. I made myself a salad at the salad bar and took it to go.
How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Thank you. $6.50.
The credit card receipt had a blank space next to the word tip. Now, the person behind the counter didn't do any more work for me than the staff at Taco Bell. So, should I leave a tip? Here's another example. Last fall, I visited my neighborhood sushi restaurant. When the bill came, it had a tip guide printed across the bottom. I paid with credit card. When the credit card receipt arrived, it also had a tip guide. Both suggested a tip of 20% or 25%. But the corresponding dollar amounts were different. Why? You may have guessed, one receipt calculated the tip after sales tax. I spoke to waiter Jeff Lee about the discrepancy. Though he's on the receiving end, Lee says he doesn't really care if customers tip before or after tax.
It really wouldn't be like a significant difference, maybe like a difference of a couple cents, maybe like not even a dollar most of the time.
Apparently, other customers here are equally indifferent.
Have other consumers said anything about that?
Actually, you're the only one who's brought that issue up.
It might be unfair to make Lee the arbiter of a tip question. He grew up in South Korea.
In South Korea, there is no tip. They're offended, basically, if you tip them.
I expected the management here might be concerned about offending me with its conflicting and inflated tip guides. At the least, I thought they'd fix the discrepancy. I was wrong.
When I spoke with the head office, they said there's nothing that they can do about it. It's up to the credit card machines.
Let's say goodbye to the sushi bar.
Arigatou gozaimashita.
And stop by a fondue restaurant called The Melting Pot. The waiter's job here is labor-intensive. They make fondue at your table.
All right, we had a little cilantro here.
Garlic, we like or we love?
I don't trust people that don't like garlic.
The bill here also has a tip guide. The suggested rates range from 15% up to 25%. I asked the restaurant's director of operations, Dana Robertson, should people feel guilty about leaving less than 20% tip?
They should tip what they feel their service was. So, I mean, customary tip nowadays in restaurants, I would say, is between 15 and 18%.
National studies show the average tip is 18%, but service may not have much to do with it. Mike Lin is a professor at the School of Hotel Administration at Cornell University. He points to studies showing that the weather can be as influential on tips.
If it's sunny outside, you tip more, and that relationship between weather and tipping is as strong as the relationship between service and tipping.
If service isn't a significant variable, does that mean that I should tip the same rate for alcohol?
Etiquette experts suggest that you're supposed to tip on the total bill, and that includes alcohol, wine, all of it, except not taxes.
Hear that, sushi restaurant? No tipping on the tax. But in practice, many people do anyway. I asked Lynn how we ended up with this vague financial convention. No one knows for sure, he says, but there are some interesting theories.
George Foster, who's a retired anthropologist from the University of Berkeley, has argued that tipping originated in eating and drinking places as a way to prevent the workers of those places from being envious of you as a customer.
There is some evidence to support this.
The word tip in many, many different languages around the world translates to drink money or money for drink, and in some Asian countries, money for tea.
In terms of modern tipping conventions, I wondered about tips on to-go orders. Lynn says it's becoming more common, but
I think it's crazy and I don't do it.
At the deli where I take my salad to-go, I feel bad if I leave the tip space blank. I assumed other customers might have a similarly guilty reaction. So I expected people using credit cards would tip more than those who paid in cash. Wrong again. Jack Alicia is the general manager of Trimana.
We receive 10 times more cash as a tip in the tip jar.
Customers will pay for a $7.50 bill with a 10 spot and deposit the change in the tip jar. He says it happens 5 or 6 times a day. That's one limit on technology. Credit cards don't leave you with an annoying pocket full of change just waiting for a tip jar. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Okay, so really, what do you do about tips? We want to know. You can post on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org/money, and there you will also find some responses to that question from people across the country. Jeff mentioned that people are more inclined to put money in a tip jar than to put a small gratuity on plastic. Maybe it's because they're afraid of getting a fee tacked on to that credit transaction. That fear would have been justified over the last several years as credit cards added ding after ding to bills and purchases. But a little over a year ago, Congress passed the Credit Card Act to crack down on some of the more egregious bank behavior. A new report from the Pew Safe Credit Cards Project finds that, for the most part, it worked. Nick Bork is the project's director. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Based on this report, it sounds like the Credit Card Act has done a lot of what it was supposed to do, at least when it comes to interest rates and some fees.
Yes, it has. Based on our research, we're looking at a situation where 100% of credit cards used to have practices that regulators called unfair or deceptive. Now those practices have gone away, but we have credit cards that don't have annual fees. We have lots of credit cards that still look pretty good for consumers.
Can you give us some numbers on that?
So one of the claims we heard before the Credit Card Act was that the elimination of these practices that regulators were going after would lead to drastic increases in prices and additions of new fees, including annual fees. So we've been tracking that, and what we found is that even today, about 1 in 5 credit cards has an annual fee. That's up only slightly from last year and only slightly from a few years ago. And the size of these fees has not gone up in the past year. For banks, the median annual fee is $59, and for credit unions, the median annual fee is $25.
But the big problem here, of course, is that the banks have found so many other ways around the legislation, right? I mean, you released a different study a couple of weeks ago about checking account fees, and those are skyrocketing, and you have these long disclosure statements now about those.
Absolutely. It's a constant challenge to make the market work in a way that is profitable, yet also transparent and not harmful for consumers. And so whether you're talking about clear disclosures, which is something that we really need to work on with checking accounts, or while you're talking about ongoing adjustments to the credit card industry as it finds its new equilibrium, there are a lot of challenges that regulators need to continue working on.
Can you give us a quick rundown of the checking fee study that you did?
The median length of a checking account disclosure is 111 pages.
Good Lord.
And it's even worse than that because a consumer, if they really want to inform themselves about what's happening, they can't just look on the first couple pages of that. They really have to skim through 111 pages of material to find all of the relevant information about fees and how are you going to credit my paycheck and how are you going to debit the checks that I use.
Well, if the upshot of your study over the last year for credit cards is that that legislation actually did work and did what it was supposed to do, what do you think is still missing from consumer protections?
I think what we need to focus on with credit cards is making sure that there's ongoing clear transparency and to make sure that new problems don't develop. One issue that we've been watching is promotions and offering deferred payments, you know, 0% interest for 12 months for that sort of thing.
What's wrong with that?
The only reason that a deferred interest program is offered is because a merchant wants to sell more product or because a lender wants to gamble that a certain percentage of people who take out these deferred loan programs will not be able to pay in full at the end or will make a mistake. It's a big issue for them because if you take out a $1,000 deferred payment loan, and at the end of the term, the 12 months or whatever it is, if you haven't paid all of that $1,000, you're going to get hit with interest on the full $1,000 all the way back to the origination date, no matter what you've paid along the way.
Good cautionary tales. Nick Bork is the director of Pew's Safe Credit Cards Project, and we've been talking about their recent study on the Credit Card Act. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Our money habits are often, well, terrible. We are rude with our money. We display bad money manners. And so with that, we wish you Happy National Etiquette Week. Yes, there really is a National Etiquette Week, a special time to recognize courtesy, civility, good manners, and bring attention to those breaches in etiquette that drive you crazy, including all those money faux pas. So here with some timely advice about money etiquette is our good friend Emily Yaffe, also known as Dear Prudence at Slate.com. And Emily, where, oh, where do we start with this one?
I wanted to start with, since this is graduation season, please, please, high school and college graduates, sit down and write, yes, write the thank you note to people who have given you gifts and checks.
What, an email doesn't do it anymore?
You know what? Actually, an email would be fine because I have sent many gifts and checks to graduates, and I don't care if you graduate from law school, get married, have quadruplets, I will never send you another check because you never thanked me.
So it doesn't matter what form the thank you comes in, just as long as you get one.
Yes, I wanted acknowledgement that I've done something that means something to you. So just, what is it going to be, 2 minutes? Do it, kids.
All right. Graduates, you're on notice. Well, we asked our Facebook and Twitter fans to write in with their etiquette questions, so let's go ahead and get to them. Belinda Crone asks what to do when her family goes out to dinner and everybody tries to grab the check to one-up everyone else.
Oh, boy, can I join your family? I mean, just sit there. Let someone else say my turn. But that's something that people can talk about.
All right. Well, this could, I think, apply to either family or a group of friends. You know, when someone suggests that a group go out to dinner and then it ends up being at a very expensive restaurant and there are folks in the group who clearly cannot afford it. What do you do?
I am so glad you brought this up, because I want to say something about this adult birthday celebration. I think it is just the height of rudeness to say, we're going to a really, really nice place, which literally, at the end of the evening, by the time all the wine's drunk, can put you back $100, $150.
Yep.
And even if you sat there saying, okay, I'm going to have one glass of wine and a salad, it doesn't matter because you're stuck dividing up this huge bill. I think it's fine if you hear it's going to be at Shea mortgage payment to say, oh, God, I wish I could be there, but I just can't.
Here is another one from our Facebook page. This one from Colleen Marie Kohlmeyer Brooks. What is the proper etiquette for notifying friends, family, and neighbors that you are foreclosing on your house?
Oh,
tough
dear.
One.
That's a word of mouth kind of situation. You know, making a mass announcement of something really awkward like that, I don't think is necessary.
All right. Well, speaking of recession-related issues, I think over the last 3 years or so during the downturn, lots of people have faced the question of how to gently talk about gift giving, maybe to forego it or do like a $10 maximum or something. It can be really awkward, I think, for both sides of that.
I think you just have to talk about it. If it's with friends who you normally exchange birthday presents or whatever, you have to say, you know what, this year we're trying to dig ourselves out of the hole. Please, let's not exchange gifts. As far as families are concerned, you just have to say, can't do birthday gift exchanges, can't do Christmas this year. Well, you're being a Grinch. Yeah. I mean, you just cannot be bullied into putting yourself deeper into a financial hole.
Well, we just heard a story about tipping, but I don't think it addressed this question, also from our Facebook page. David Osaki wants to know what to do for the delivery driver, pizza or otherwise. He says some people have suggested a fixed amount since the driver does the same work no matter how much they're bringing to you, or a percentage of the bill as if you were dining in the restaurant.
Interesting. I give like $5. Because it's a door delivery. If I, you know, it's the same if the pizza's coming or if I've ordered a meal to be delivered. But I'm willing to hear from other people. The thing is, this person is not your waiter or waitress. So, you know, it's not this extended providing service beyond appearing at your door. So I think the fixed amount is fine. But let me know if people disagree.
Oh, believe me, they will. And they may not be very nice about it either. Emily Yaffe offers her take on matters of etiquette, manners, and morals as Dear Prudence at Slate.com. Thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ted.
All right. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to the Twin Cities to visit someone we met a little while ago on the show. Ellen is the elementary school Spanish teacher who is about to lose her job because of cuts to the education budget there. We applaud Ellen for trying to get in front of what could be a very tough financial situation, one with no immediate answers. So, Ellen, to help you save every penny possible while you're away from the classroom, our pig is on the way. We hope Ellen is able to use the advice we gave her this week to find creative ways to generate some more income. In the meantime, we thank her for her service as a teacher. Each week, we're giving out a Marketplace Money pig, and you can find photos of him, her, on our website and on our Facebook page. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Have we mentioned we're on Facebook? And do follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, when is a teenager's money truly her own?
Right now, you have all of $300 in the bank. If you go to a college that costs only $300, you have your own money. Otherwise, you don't.
All right. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.